This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Our next guest is one of the best-known and most outspoken lawyers in America. Alan Dershowitz is as smart as he is controversial. Mention his name and reactions range from astonishingly brilliant to war criminal.
And that's no exaggeration. Both those descriptions appear on the back cover of his new autobiography. The blurbs include praise from President Bill Clinton and President Barack Obama, who thanks Dershowitz for his friendship and counsel.
They also include a cold dismissal from Jimmy Carter, who says, quote, "I don't read Dershowitz," and an outright put-down from Noam Chomsky, who says, "Dershowitz is not very bright and strongly opposed to civil liberties." Suffice it to say, Alan Dershowitz provokes strong reactions from critics and admirers.
Well, we know that Alan Dershowitz has had a long and distinguished career teaching at Harvard and has been in the thick of some of the country's most important criminal cases and legal debates. From the O.J. Simpson trial to seminal arguments about free speech rights, separation of church and state, affirmative action, the right to privacy, it goes on and on. He's also been a guest on this show, and we're happy to welcome him back. His new book, his new autobiography, is called Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law. And Alan Dershowitz, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoy the show so much.
Well, it's nice of you to say that. So first, I do have to ask you, I know that we don't want to judge a book by the cover, but the cover is very entertaining, and I have to ask you about those blurbs, because I think it's the first time I've seen blurbs that both praise and condemn a book like yours.
Yeah, I'm controversial, and I thrive on controversy. I know that nobody's neutral about me. People love me or hate me, and I wanted to put that right out there. For my 50th anniversary at Harvard, Larry David sent a videotape. They had a big event at Harvard commemorating the 50 years, and Larry said, look, the world is divided into two groups, people who know Alan personally and really love him and people who don't know him and hate him. He says, I'm in the third category. I know Alan very well, and I hate his guts. He said, and then he went on to say he hates me because I'm smart. He hates me, you know, praised me with, damned me with faint praise, but that's true.
Well, listeners, we're talking to Alan Dershowitz. He's the Harvard Law professor and very well-known lawyer. He has a new autobiography. It's called Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law. What's your question for the Harvard Law professor who's taught there for some 50 years, whether it is the O.J. Simpson trial or big issues around First Amendment rights, civil liberties, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Boston. Alan Dershowitz, there's so much great stuff in here that I want to talk to you about. The law, of course, but you tell the story of your life. So I wonder if we could just start by going back a little bit to the boy who grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family in Brooklyn right around the Second World War. You write about your childhood with a lot of color, hanging out on the stoop, the bookstore owner who looked like Trotsky, the rule-based Judaism that you practiced. What kind of an education did you have growing up?
Oh, a miserable education. I went to a pretty bad Jewish elementary school and high school, and my grades showed it. In the book, I have a photograph of my report card in my senior year in high school. I got a 60 in mathematics, a flunk, 60 in physics, flunk, 65 in Hebrew, 65 in history, and my highest grade was an 80 in English, all for a 67 average, and I was therefore suspended from the varsity basketball team for academic reasons. I can imagine being suspended. Most people would probably think I was suspended for athletic reasons, but I was a pretty good basketball player, but a terrible, terrible student.
Well, what were you doing? Were you already thinking about deep constitutional questions? Instead of paying attention to your schoolwork.
I did think of a deep constitutional question. In my senior year, the school told me I could not take the New York State Scholarship Exam, which paid you $1,400 to go to college. I came from a pretty poor family. I wanted to take the exam. School said you needed an 80 average to take it. So I brought a lawsuit against my high school, and I won. And they allowed me to take the New York State Scholarship, and I won a New York State Scholarship. So I was able to go to college. I went to Brooklyn College. It was a great school, free school. And I put $1,400 in my bank account, and I was able to pay for my first year at law school.
Wow. You tell a great story before you get to Brooklyn College about getting accused of breaking your friend's leg on the playground in school and how that incident actually inspired you to become a defense lawyer?
Right. I was innocent, and my mother came and defended me. My mother, who graduated high school at 15 and a half and was the first person in her family ever to start college, but it was the Depression. She had to drop out to help support the family. But my mother was brilliant, and she came in and drew charts and showed the principal that I couldn't possibly be guilty. And she made me want to be a lawyer. And she always wanted to be a lawyer, but, you know, it was too late for her. So, you know, a little bit she lived through me and my younger brother, who also became a great lawyer.
I was struck really early in the book. You came up with a line that I really appreciated. You say you can't explain your worldview without describing those on whose shoulders you stand. And, and your worldview very much shaped by decisions of your great-grandparents and grandparents who left the shtetls of Poland and moved to New York. Had they remained in Europe, you point out, as some of your relatives did, you probably would not have survived the Holocaust. So, you know, how does that background shape your view of the law?
Well, let me give you a specific example. I am very, very favorably inclined toward immigration into the United States, and I don't want to treat illegal immigrants as badly as many Americans do, because some of my family came here as illegal immigrants. The proudest thing my grandfather did, who was as poor as could be, is he created false affidavits for 29 members of my family on the eve of the Holocaust and saved every single one of them. And he committed a crime in doing so. These illegal immigrants came to America. One of them was the chairman of the Department of Engineering at Columbia. Another was a rabbi in Los Angeles. They have all contributed enormously to this country, and they were illegal immigrants.
Wow. Well, so obviously that obviously leaves you with strong feelings about this sort of endless debate that we see in Washington about immigration.
Absolutely, and it also leads me to have strong feelings about defending the underdog. I grew up when my people were underdogs, and I was beaten up from time to time. I did a pretty good job in defending myself, but I was a street-smart kid, and that's affected the way I look at the law.
Well, listeners, what's your question for Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law professor for some 50 years, high-profile defense attorney, defender of First Amendment rights, civil liberties, O.J. Simpson? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So I want to ask you about some big arguments that you've been involved with in law. And let's start with free speech. You write that everything in your upbringing led you to the defense of freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. As a kid, your personality was defined by speaking your mind and questioning the views of others. And you've defended countless First Amendment cases, from pornography to the Pentagon Papers. So let me start there with pornography. You defended several cases involving obscenity, including the film Deep Throat.
Right.
But you haven't seen the film.
I never have seen it, and I didn't want to see it because I wasn't defending the film Deep Throat. Right. I was defending choice. I didn't want to see it. I chose not to see it. And I said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, judges, you can either choose to see it or not to see it. This is about choice, not about the content of the film. And as long as the film isn't thrust on you, as long as there's no advertising that is offensive, whatever goes on inside a movie theater is none of the state's business.
Now, this is an issue that actually took you before the Supreme Court at the rather tender age of 31, right?
That's right. And I argued the case in front of one of the dumbest justices in the history of America, Warren Burger, who kept asking me about bear baiting, and he just couldn't understand my argument. My argument was a very simple one. He probably deliberately refused to understand it. He filibustered the entire half an hour, and I didn't even get a chance really to make my argument. I won the case here in the federal district court in front of Judge Aldridge, established for the first time the principle that what goes on inside a theater is none of the state's business. And then the United States Supreme Court reversed me, and the law changed, and you could now ban pornography and turn on your cable television and see who really won. I mean, obviously, everything can be seen today on cable TV. We won in the marketplace of ideas.
So we won in the marketplace of ideas, but you note that the Supreme Court has continued to, and actually didn't know this, to insist that obscenity is not protected by the First Amendment?
Absolutely. If literally you could go to jail for 10 years if you show, buy, possess even an obscene film, an adult obscene film, like the film Deep Throat. And my other case was I Am Curious Yellow. Today you could show that as an R-rated film on probably network television. And a man from the Symphony Cinema Theater right across the street from Symphony Hall in the old Boston was threatened with a year in jail for showing that film.
Now, because of your defense, I mean, I know you were defending freedom of expression, but it was sort of interpreted that you were defending dirty films. You became something of a pariah among some feminists who regarded such films as dangerously sexist. What was your response to that kind of criticism?
Well, the films were sexist. I mean, yeah. I Am Curious Yellow, but I'm sure Deep Throat. I saw actually excerpts from it when they had a filming of the making of Deep Throat. It was a horribly sexist movie, a terrible movie, a commodified women. But that's not my point. I also defend anti-Semites who marched through Skokie, Illinois. I'm not defending the content of the speech. I'm defending the right to express freedom of speech. Look, I was considering representing a young man named Matthew Hale, who wanted to put Jews in gas chambers, but as long as he was expressing those views, not inciting violent behavior, I believe in defending all free speech.
Well, let's move on to another conversation about free speech, and this is free speech that supports terrorism. You point out that Congress has passed laws punishing anyone who knowingly provides, and I'll quote now, material support or resources to any foreign terrorist organization. So that can include speeches, writings, other forms of expression. And we've seen the conviction here in Massachusetts of a young man named Tariq Mahana, who was convicted of providing material support for Al-Qaeda. His crimes included translating and posting online material that prosecutors said was Al-Qaeda propaganda. So what do you make of this issue? Where are we? How do we walk that fine line between protecting ourselves and upholding free speech?
We have free speech between wars. During wars, free speech is always compromised. In the First World War, we put people in jail. In the Second World War, during the McCarthy period, and now in our war against terrorism, the first casualty, not the first, obviously, 9/11, 3,000 people killed, but the first civil liberties casualty is free speech. And today, you cannot make a speech which is perceived to be in support of a terrorist group. And that's a terrible constriction of the First Amendment, and I would hope the Supreme Court would put an end to it if an appropriate case came before them.
Yeah, and are you confident that it would?
Because, no.
Really?
No, I'm not confident that it would. Mm. I think when it comes to terrorism, you cannot count on civil liberties being upheld in any context, which is why probably the most controversial thing I've ever espoused in my life has been so misunderstood. I'm categorically opposed to torture under all circumstances, no exceptions. But I know that torture is occurring, would occur. If we ever had a ticking bomb case, we'd use it. So I want to have a torture warrant, just like I'm opposed to the death penalty, but I want to have a warrant before you can execute anybody. And people have confused that as somehow favoring torture, which I don't do.
But if you say and this is really interesting, actually, you have to help me with this because I gotta say, I don't quite understand the distinction of how you can advocate for a warrant, but that not being interpreted as therefore there's a place for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no place for it. If we could abolish torture, you have my vote immediately. Yeah. But if we're going to have torture, if I lose the first debate, I want to at least win the second debate. Let's have accountability. Yeah. Let's know if the President of the United States authorized it. I don't want to leave it to lower ranking CIA officials to decide who to torture, who not to torture, and under what circumstances.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, you write really provocatively and interestingly about WikiLeaks and mm-hmm. Julian Assange, who you met and who you provided some legal counsel to. And you call the Pentagon Papers child's play compared with WikiLeaks.
Yep.
So you met with Julian Assange in London. Why did you get involved in the case, and why is it so significant?
Well, it's the new Pentagon Papers case of the 21st century because we're moving from print media, obviously, to much more electronic-based media, and WikiLeaks is the New York Times, Washington Post of the 2000s. And if Julian Assange and WikiLeaks get prosecuted, it's only a small baby step to going back and prosecuting the New York Times for publishing material that was improperly obtained by someone else, given to the media, and published. Look, I have no brief for Snowden. I have no brief for Ellsberg. I have no brief for the people who actually steal the material. They're whistleblowers. They engage in civil disobedience. They can be judged morally, but legally, they're guilty. On the other hand, the New York Times publishing the stolen material by Ellsberg, that's very different. And Assange is just like the New York Times. He didn't encourage Manning to steal the material. Greenwald didn't encourage, as far as I know, Snowden to steal the material. So we have to distinguish between those who stole the material and engaged in an act of civil disobedience and those who published it pursuant to the First Amendment. Their action is completely legal.
Interesting. You sort of point out that there's even a double standard at play here. That is, Julian Assange is being pursued while someone like Seymour Hersh, one of our sort of more respected reporters, frequently publishes material that, material that he got from sources that he shouldn't have gotten a hold of.
Yesterday's New York Times had a story that said the following quote is anonymous because it came from a person who understood he was providing us with classified material. That appears in the Times, that appears in Time magazine, that appears all the time. It's a standard journalistic tactic. Seymour Hersh, Woodward, but they do it for respectable newspapers and magazines, and they get a pass, although legally their action is no different from Assange.
But isn't the difference one of degree and one of sort of editorial responsibility, I guess? Isn't the feeling about Assange is that he's just sort of saying, put it all out there, whatever it is, not my problem.
Well, remember, he gave it to the New York Times and to Figaro and to other newspapers who were then making the editorial judgment. So you might call him a middleman, but we don't want to equate journalistic integrity and ethics with violations of the First Amendment. You can criticize people who do what Assange is alleged to have done, but to draw a constitutional line would be very dangerous.
Alan, let's take a couple of calls. We've got a lot of folks that are already in line to talk to you. We're talking to Alan Dershowitz about his new book, Taking the Stand, My Life and the Law. It's a new autobiography. 800-423-8255. Let's go to Danielle, who's calling from Brighton. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, it's great to be on the show. I'm calling because I...
Danielle, I'm just going to ask you to hold on for 2 seconds because we had a technical issue. Are you hearing Danielle now, Alan Dershowitz?
Hi, Danielle, do you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. Can you hear me?
I hear you perfectly.
Okay, Danielle, go ahead with your question.
Okay, so I'm calling because in 2008, I enrolled in Hampshire College in... Amherst, Massachusetts.
Right. My son went there. Right.
Yes, I know. And I'm a Jewish student raised in a very Zionist household. And I was excited to go to Hampshire because it was an innovative school. And when I got there, I saw how much anti-Zionism there was. And there was a lot of hatred towards people who supported Israel there. Among the students, and I ran into a lot of that, and then you wrote an open letter to President Hoekstra during the BDS campaign to divest all of Hampshire's funds from any organization that supported Israel and called for Jewish students to divest from Hampshire College. And I wanted you to know that I did do that, and I transferred to UMass Amherst. And I was very grateful for your support and how you stood up for Israel in that situation. And I just wanted to thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I stand up for a single standard. I would be in favor of divesting from countries that violate human rights. Let's start with Iran and Syria and China and Cuba and get to Israel where it belongs on the list of human rights violators, near the very, very, very bottom of the list. But instead, on some universities, only Israel is the subject of divestment petitions. And that is a double standard. And I will fight that double standard with my own free speech and fighting back and saying, if you divest, we divest. And that has been fairly effective. I am critical of some Israeli policies. I'm critical of the settlements. I wish they would be more generous in making a peace offer to the Palestinians. I think Israel making peace today with the Palestinians would be a great thing for the world, for in the Middle East. It would also help focus attention on Iran. But I'm not going to allow my criticism of particular policies to be translated into singling out Israel as the only country in the world that deserves the attention of human rights activists. You know, you can have a demonstration today at Oxford, at Cambridge, and many other universities in Europe and in the United States if Israel digs up 6 olive trees, but you can't get 10 people out there to protest the killing of 100,000 Syrians. So there is a double standard in selective prosecution, and that's what I'm fighting. And I address that in my book, Taking the Stand, because I'm still a liberal, I'm still a civil libertarian, I haven't changed my views, but many on college campuses think of me as a conservative today because I am perceived as a supporter of Israel, and that is seen as a conservative cause. But I defend Israel from a liberal perspective.
All right. And Danielle, thank you so much for that call. Let's move on to another call and another issue. John is calling from Northampton. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is this. What has been your greatest failure as a lawyer and trial lawyer, and what have you learned from it?
I think my greatest failure has been I have not succeeded in abolishing the death penalty. I started on that campaign. Look, I debated it when I was in high school. I signed my first petition to spare the life of the Rosenbergs. I have been fighting against capital punishment since I'm 12 years old. In the book, I describe how I played a very important role in the Supreme Court as a law clerk in writing the first opinion challenging the constitutionality of the death penalty. And we won in Furman versus Georgia in 1970. But then the Supreme Court really overruled itself and allows the death penalty. And we're the only country, really, in the Western world that permits the death penalty. And we as a country don't have the death penalty. We really have the death penalty in Florida, in Texas, in Georgia, in a half dozen other states. And we're a divided country in a divided world. And I won't rest until I can see the abolition of the death penalty.
I want to ask you about your opposition to that. You write very eloquently in your book about this. And at one point, and I recall this, and you wrote about this, you urged Israel not to execute John Demjanjuk, the
right.
Ukrainian death camp guard who was responsible for probably the murder of a very high number of Jews. And you wrote, if ever there was a case that cried out for the death penalty, this would be it. Given your background with family members who died in the Holocaust, why did you argue to spare Demjanjuk's life?
Because the next sentence was, if there was ever a case in which if you didn't impose the death penalty, it would show it shouldn't be imposed on anybody. It's the Demjanjuk case. And I had started, by the way, opposing the death penalty in the Eichmann case. Eichmann was the architect of the Holocaust. And I said to Israel, if you don't execute Eichmann, you will be a beacon unto the world and will show the world the time has come to abolish the death penalty. Look what happened in Norway. A guy in Norway kills almost 100 young people. He gets 15 years in prison, I think 15, maybe 20, and the Norwegian people are satisfied because that's the highest penalty you can get. Now, I think that's too low a penalty. I think life imprisonment would be appropriate for him. But I want to see the death penalty become as anachronistic as, you know, cutting people's limbs off and quartering them as we used to do 400 years ago.
Well, we know that public opinion is weakening across the country for the death penalty. Fewer and fewer states have statutes that they actually apply. Do you think it's inevitable that is it going to be sort of waning public support that is going to finally abolish the death penalty?
Sure.
Or is it going to be a legal challenge?
It will be waning public support, I think. In America, ultimately the people rule, not the Supreme Court. You know, in my book, I argue the Supreme Court's an overrated institution and has been losing credibility over the years, will continue to lose credibility. Mm-hmm. I would rather see the death penalty abolished legislatively. The problem with that, of course, is after your first next terrorist attack or mass murder or event like what happened in the Boston Marathon, you get calls back for the death penalty. Interestingly enough, we haven't seen that here, even on the basis of the Boston Marathon. You know, people have said, let's give this young man the death penalty, but there hasn't been a real outcry about it. I think sentiments about the death penalty are changing somewhat, but it's a slow, gradual process.
Let's take another call. Susan is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Professor Dershowitz, my concern is about the media.
Mm-hmm.
I remember during the Vietnam War, the media was extremely aggressive, independent, speaking truth to power, standing up and confronting the generals who said, oh, everything's going great.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that anymore. My question is, why is it legal for all these media mergers? I thought we had an antitrust act, but it seems like the media now is owned, operated, and delivered by maybe two or three people or institutions. And I think that's really...
But let's think about the facts. Let's think about the facts. But John Henry, who I have to say is a close personal friend of mine, I love him. I think he's a fantastic guy, just bought the Boston Globe. John is a progressive, liberal. His ownership of the Globe will certainly be probably felt over the years. The Washington Post was just bought by, you know, Bezos. Other newspapers are in trouble. I don't agree with you. I think the media is alive and well. I think what's wrong with the media today is when you go to Fox, it's totally predictable what you're going to hear. When you go to MSNBC, it's pretty predictable what you're going to hear. It's hard to find places where you can really get unvarnished news reports that are objective, and it's important. That's why public radio is so important as well, which is not influenced by who owns it. But I think we have a pretty healthy media atmosphere in this country.
But don't you think? I mean, Susan's referring to the consolidation of what's certainly happening with newspapers across the country. Yep. Isn't that sort of a isn't that a risk?
If it is
you
a risk.
Play that out down the road a bit.
It is a risk, and it's a risk that I don't think the antitrust laws can deal with. I would be very worried about applying the antitrust laws to the media. I think it could endanger the First Amendment. Look, we have a great conflict between freedom of speech and money. Citizens United, which I write about in Taking the Stand, poses a very difficult conflict. You want Sheldon Adelson to be able to exercise his right of free speech. I have to identify he, too, is one of my clients and my friend. On the other hand, he uses it in a way that many of us disapprove of on the merits. So how do you resolve that conflict between allowing people to exercise their free speech by spending lots of money? I don't believe that he drowns anybody else out. He is part of the marketplace of ideas.
Interesting. I want to move on to another subject that you write about in the book. As most of us know, you've represented or provided legal advice to just a whole slew of famous people. It's really impressive when you read the list. I mean, we know about O.J. Simpson, Klaus Van Bulow, Bill Clinton, Mike Tyson. The list goes on and on. You've been called, among other things, very high profile, a celebrity lawyer. You say you don't like that characterization.
No. Look, 50% of my cases have been pro bono. Most of my clients have been people you've never heard of, obscure people who get in trouble. A woman calls me from a mental hospital. I spend days and days trying to get her out of the mental hospital. Obviously, I don't want to write about that case because I don't want people to know the name of the woman who was in the mental hospital. But my career has not been a celebrity career. I have done a good job freeing people from prison. Therefore, celebrities come to me when they get in trouble. And I turn down as many celebrities as I accept. I never take a case because it's a celebrity, but I have had a lot of celebrity clients. I've also opposed celebrity clients. I was the lawyer on the other side of the Woody Allen case. I've been the lawyer on the other side of many such cases.
Speaking of turning down celebrity requests, you have a great story in your book about being approached by the very eccentric Bobby Fischer, the former chess champion. Mm-hmm. Tell us what happened.
And that's before I was a well-known lawyer at all. He came to see me engrossing his hotel in the Catskill Mountains. He was preparing for his match with Boris Spassky. And he asked me if I would represent him free to try to trademark his moves. And I said, oh, sure. But would you do me a favor and play a chess game with my 10-year-old son who was learning chess? And he said, I'm not a circus performer. I would never play chess with your son. And I said, I'm not a circus performer. I'm not going to represent you free. And that was the last I saw of him. And I was not surprised at the end of his career.
Let me ask you about the principle that most lawyers embrace, and I know that you do, this idea that everyone, no matter who they are or what they've done, has the right to robust legal defense. Can you tell me a story where you stuck to that principle and felt bad about it afterward?
I feel bad about it almost all the time when I help win a case for somebody who I've come to believe is guilty. The first time it really hit me hard is when I represented a kid I grew up with in Borough Park. I tell the story in Brooklyn, who helped make the bomb that was planted in Saul Yurok's office, which produced the death of a young woman. And it was purely on the basis of a legal theory I constructed that we won the case, and all these kids went free who were responsible for a death. I felt horrible. I said, this is what I went to law school for? This is what I worked so hard for to help?
But why did you do that? I mean, at that point, when you became convinced that they were not guilty, why not just stop representing them.
You can't quit a case in the middle, number one. Number two, guilty people have the right to a defense. Mm-hmm. Look, most of my clients have been guilty. Thank God for that. Would you want to live in a country where most people charged with crime are innocent? That might be Iran or China. In the United States, most people charged with crime are guilty. And in order to keep it that way, you have to zealously defend everybody, whether they're guilty or innocent. Always put pressure on the government. Always make them prove their case by legitimate means beyond a reasonable doubt. That's my job.
Well, it's a principle that is, of course, important. I can only imagine that sometimes it's got to sort of work at cross purposes with.
Just today, I had a case where I helped a young man who had been accused of killing 9 Buddhist monks and nuns. I write about this case. It's the Jonathan Duty case, and he was convicted. And I won a reversal, along with my brother's law firm and a woman named Vicky Iger. We won a reversal of his conviction. And just today, he was retried and got a hung jury after he had been convicted. And, of course, we never know as lawyers whether our clients are guilty or innocent or somewhere in between. It's the job of the system to separate the guilty from the innocent. It's our job to advocate for our clients. We don't have to feel good about the result, just like a doctor doesn't feel good when he helps save the life of a man who's going to go out and do terrible things, or a priest gives absolution to somebody who goes out and does terrible things. But we all have important jobs to do in a democracy, and we wouldn't want to live in a country in which zealot criminal defense lawyers didn't defend people to the limits of the ethics.
Early on in the book, in your introduction, you acknowledge that Alan Dershowitz's public persona is, and you use these words, confrontational, unapologetic, brash, tough, argumentative, and uncompromising. But you say those of you, those who know you personally, mm-hmm. know a very different man.
Oh, I'm a pushover.
I find that hard to believe.
My family runs. I'm a doormat. I never say no to my wife. I have never yelled at anybody who's worked for me. I'm very easy to get along with, and I don't use confrontation in my personal life. I just I have a very, very different personal approach than I do in my professional life.
Well, how did you hone all that public persona to be, you know, that the confrontational, the unapologetic, the brash, the tough, the argumentative?
I grew up in Brooklyn. had I grown up in some neighborhoods in Boston, it probably would have been the same. But, you know, I grew up on the streets, and you develop that ability, and you always fight back. And my father always said, defend the underdog. Don't rat out anybody. He taught me a whole set of ethics that, have really been important in my professional life.
You've said many times you're a teacher, you're a practicing lawyer as well, and you bring these two sort of jobs together, and they both benefit one from the other. And there's a great example in here. You write that the most intriguing example of this involves the shooting of a corpse.
Right.
I want to end with this anecdote.
I had a client who shot a corpse. And he was convicted first of murder and then of attempted murder because he thought the person was alive when he shot him, but he was not. And it involved very abstract legal theories. And I brought into the courtroom what I had been teaching in the classroom, and we ended up winning the case. And then I took the case back to the classroom and helped to teach students, generations of students, about the law of attempts and conspiracy based on that case. So bringing the courtroom into the classroom, I think, may be a better teacher and a better practitioner.
It's fantastic. Well, Alan Dershowitz, you write that you have lived the passion and action of your times, and sitting here talking to you about all of these important legal cases and everything that you've done, all these people you've met, that is certainly true. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Alan Dershowitz, well-known Harvard lawyer. His new biography is called Taking the Stand, My Life in the Law. And listeners, you can post your comments and questions if you want to continue this conversation at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Trinity Rep's Kurt Columbus takes us on a tour of his favorite neighborhood in Providence. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.